Hello, listeners. We are Lib Voices. Hear from librarians of color what speaks to the fullness of their careers, including successes and challenges. How do they do it? Join us to find out more about their Lib Voices. Welcome to episode 10, our last episode of this season. Today, we have an interview with Laura Tadena. Laura Tadena, she, her, hers, is an inclusive services consultant at the Texas State Library and Archives Commission in Austin, Texas. She is Tahana from South Texas and a former school and diversity resident librarian. She is also one of the site admins of a national resident Slack workspace that provides a safe community space for individuals currently or who have previously been in a resident librarian positions. Laura is passionate about the advancement, recruitment, and retention of BIPOC library staff and increasing opportunities for mentorship and leadership development. Laura's background is in architecture and education. She specializes in addressing inequities in the built environment, creating inclusive and welcoming library spaces and services, and developing accessible and culturally competent educational opportunities.
What drew you to librarianship?
So very similar to some of the other librarian stories that you'll hear. I didn't grow up knowing that librarianship was going to be my future career path. My mother was a school principal, so I did grow up running around a school and spending a lot of time in the school library, especially in the summers. And I just liked hanging out around books. And when I was in college, I tried to work at a university library in a bookstore, but at the time you used to have to fill out a questionnaire, and for some reason, like, never got hired. Wow. And it's probably because, you know, like, I think what most people would envision what librarians look like, which I have a lot of problems with that statement, like all librarians look like. But you know, I'm not like what you would consider quote unquote the traditional fit. Like I'm loud. I have a different background. I didn't, grow up like, you know, surrounded by books in this like magical land. Like it was just something that I kind of stumbled upon. And so, my undergraduate degree is in architecture. So when I entered the workforce, it was right before the 2008 recession. And so when that hit, I was out of a job and I had to find a different career path. And so my mom encouraged me to try teaching and I ended up really enjoying it. I ended up teaching math for about 6 years. And so it was during that time when I was teaching math that I realized that my kids and my students, they were every year they were coming in, they were struggling more and more. And it wasn't because they lacked like the math computation, it was because they just lacked comprehension skills. And so I knew that if I didn't start incorporating literacy strategies into my work, I wasn't going to be able to make the difference that I wanted to make. And so I ended up working with our campus librarian. Her name was Mary Hopkins, and she also ended up being one of my first mentors. But she encouraged me to see librarianship as a profession. And it was something that I struggled with because, again, like I grew up, I had a reading, you know, I struggled with reading when I was younger. I didn't have a background in literature, humanities. And so I was worried that I wouldn't be able to fit in to this profession. But she encouraged me. And so at the time, Texas had a shortage of school librarians. And I was able to pursue my master's of library science while working as a school librarian. And so I went through the University of North Texas online program and got my master's of library science while working as a school librarian and ended up getting a school librarian certificate as well. And here I am today.
So amazing.
Yeah, long journey.
Yes, long and interesting though. I mean, it's just, I feel like there's no traditional route, you know, for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So as a Black, Indigenous, and or person of color, what do you view as critical to the success of the field?
Yeah, representation. I think representation in our student workers, in our library staff, in our libraries, and most importantly, in our leadership and in HR positions. I can't count the number of times I've heard, like, graduate programs just aren't graduating people of color, or we keep putting these job postings out, but we're just not getting the, you know, quote unquote, diverse pool. And, you know, there's so many things wrong with these statements, but, like, okay, fine. Let's say you believe these statements are true. Like, let's unpack that. And so why are students of color not pursuing advanced degrees in library science? Like, you know, many reasons, right? Like, it's taking on the debt worth entering a field that is already underpaying their staff? Could it be that there's not representation in our libraries that we visit, and so we don't see this as a possible career path? So there's so many issues that we could pinpoint, but ultimately it comes down to, like, how white our libraries are. And, you know, I, for one, didn't see myself in library staff. I didn't see myself in the collections or the stories or in the archives. And so, like, why would I think to pursue a career in these spaces? Then they're not inclusive, right? And so I think, as far as job postings, like, if we're putting out job postings and designing them to really limit our pool and, like, narrow down our these candidates, and then by default we're, like, not casting a wide net, and we're not trying to bring in the most potential candidates that we can. And so I think, you know, we need to rethink our recruitment practices, and internally in our organizations, leadership and people in positions of power need to look around and see who always has a seat at the table, right? And who is always getting an opportunity. And if we start looking at this, like, then I think we can start making some advancements towards increasing representation, so that, you know, we have an opportunity to see what libraries can really look like, especially when we have library staff of color, and really thinking about what advancement opportunities we're giving them, what does support look like for them. And I can go on and on about representation, but ultimately representation is critical to the success of the field, because we're not going to be able to change our practices without representation. We're just going to keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So representation matters. It matters to our staff. It matters to the users that we serve. And it matters to the people that we aren't serving, right? Because we're not going to get, we don't know how to reach that audience if we don't have a different way to approach them. So, yeah, that's how I feel about representation.
I love it. You made some great points. And if you don't see yourself in something, then you don't think you belong. And so it's very important that we work on that.
Yeah, especially because, you know, like, especially as you get more and more narrow into these, like, specialties, there, you know, and the same thing when you go into leadership, you know, the more you advance, the wider the field gets. And then also, like, you don't have those safe spaces. So, yeah, it matters.
It definitely does matter. So I think this next question goes perfectly with what you were saying. How do you promote equitable practices through your work in the library, archives, et cetera?
So in my works, I'm committed towards increasing representation in every space that I'm in. And so I start by recognizing my positionality, right? Like, I come from a middle class, I'm a US citizen, I'm a light-skinned Tejana. And right now I'm in a position of privilege. And so recognizing that helps me understand what I need to do to work towards addressing these inequalities in libraries. So when given the opportunity, I try to share opportunity and bring in other voices other than my own. And by doing that, it's like bringing people into our trainings, into our webinars, amplifying other voices before putting myself first, thinking about design and building in processes where the work that we do advances those, especially the individuals that are coming from marginalized backgrounds. And then when I'm in meetings, I like to ask questions. And I know this can get old to the people that have to answer them. But when I notice like the temperature of the room is changing because there's like a shift in power, that's when I'll try to like address it and ask questions. And if the response is like, if it's about a process or something and the response is, oh, well, you know, this is done because it's always been done this way, or, you know, honestly, it's just going to make my life easier to do it this way, then we need to address that. We need to address that inequality and try to figure out a system that benefits more people than what is currently in place.
That's a good point. But I think questions are important, right? Because if you don't have any questions, then are you like really into what's going on in the moment? I'm always like really concerned when people are like, I don't have any questions. I'm just great. I'm like, okay, sure you are. Because that means that you're going to have like 500 questions later when we could have really discussed it in a group.
Mm-hmm.
That's just
Yeah. And sometimes people are afraid to ask questions. And so like people are talking, you know, our field is based on a lot of acronyms and it's a lot of like institutional knowledge. And so I find that whenever someone asks one question, it at least creates a space where it's like, oh, we have time for questions. We may answer these questions. So yeah, like just carving out a safe space so that you can have a dialogue and like really question something so that you don't have to go behind your office and try to figure it out, you know, like by yourself, or you could have asked like a question where it takes like 5 minutes to answer. And then instead of like 5 hours trying to figure out where something lives on a website, that is a form that you have to fill out that takes 3 more days to fill out, you know, like.
It's true. There are a lot of acronyms. There are a lot of things. And I do catch myself with that sometimes. I'll like spell the acronym. People are like, what are you talking about? Oh yeah, sorry. I've been, you know, I've worked in libraries for so long. It's just like second nature at this point. But I think that we have to get out of that and used to explaining things a little bit more. Because it doesn't hurt to take 5 more seconds to say, you know, association of or institution of instead of the acronym. I think we're trying to move so fast and we really have to question why we're moving that fast. But yeah, it's just something I'm thinking about.
I agree about the acronyms because, I mean, even being working in libraries for so long, I still don't know, like, how to say some of these acronyms.
Yeah.
So, it's like, oh, that's how it's said. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny, though, but there's so many of them.
Yeah, we have our own language, and a lot of times we forget that, you know, institutional knowledge is institutional knowledge, you know, or, like, you know, things that you know, we assume that people know, but really like that assumption is what creates inequity. So yeah, like just taking the time. I like when I attend presentations and people just start out and say like, I'm going to say this because I'm gonna assume that not everybody knows this, or I'm gonna, you know, like I'm gonna keep pointing to this in case you need it. And so we just have to, it's a way to think about things, but just remembering that not everybody knows, and it's okay to spell it out, you know? It's okay to take the time to explain things.
Exactly, that's a good point. So you cultivated a community of practice for a diversity residents or library diversity residents. Can you speak to the importance of such communities for residents and librarians of color in general?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so after I graduated, I ended up accepting a diversity resident position at a university in my home state, at the University of Texas at Austin. And I knew nothing about diversity residency programs, and so I was excited about this position where I got to learn and work at the same time. And it was a hard position. There's a lot of things, like we said, like this institutional knowledge that we think everybody knows, and, you know, imposter syndrome was really big, and just never, you know, there was always this like doubt of whether or not they hired the right person. So I was super fortunate that I was in a residency position in a cohort model, and I got to share the space with my colleague, Natalie. And, after a couple months in, we kept, going behind a closed door and, talking through, like, what did this mean? What do we think? And it was in this space that we realized, like, how fortunate we were to have somebody to talk to, and how we knew that there were other diversity residents who were the only one in their position, at their institutions, and they may also have been the only person of color at their institution. So there was never, they didn't have a safe space like we did. And at the time we had a listserv, but, for me as an example, I don't like to communicate through email. I feel like it has to be this like formally written statement, and it's like written and documented. And so I think a lot of people just weren't using that listserv the way I think it was initially intended. And so we wanted to create a space outside of the listserv that wasn't moderated by anybody. And we could use the space to like ask questions and kind of hear about other people's experiences and get advice, get job opportunities, and work through a lot of things. And so we created a Slack space initially for our diversity resident cohort, and then it expanded to anybody in a residency or term limited fellowship. And, over time it kind of grew. We do presentations and webinars. We help review CVs or practice job interviewing. But really it's a community space. And I think the strength of it is that you have peer mentors. You have other people that are very similar in positions that you're in, and you can ask those questions without like fear of, asking it to someone of authority or something. Like, it's just, when we say that a lot, like, we are in by no means any leadership position in this space. It's your space, it's our space. We can do with it what we want. But I think one of the benefits is, we do put on these webinars and trainings, and it gives residents opportunity to present or facilitate meetings where, at their institution, they may not be getting these opportunities. And so it's a great way to build in experience and grow as a professional.
I definitely agree. I enjoy it. I appreciate your time and energy and effort. It's a great safe space for past and present diversity residents. So thank you.
Within this space, and then I participate, I'm active on the We Hear Space Facebook group. And it's like in those spaces where I feel like, oh, okay, I'm not the only one feeling this way. Like I even if I don't respond, it's nice to be able to hear from other people and like just be able to have a place where you can say, I need support. Like I need to ask for help because I don't know how to address this and I don't have anyone in my place to ask.
Definitely agree. So our next question, you have successfully transitioned into different types of libraries throughout your career. What advice do you have for librarians looking for such change in their own careers?
So I like how you said successfully transitioned, because that's really nice to hear, because I, at the time, I didn't think it was very successful, going from one place to the other. I started in libraries. I started as a school librarian without any background working in libraries. So I was able to have my mentor, Mary, that I mentioned earlier, and then another colleague in the district that I worked at, where I would just go and ask for questions. And I'm a firm believer of good mentoring and peer mentorship. And if it wasn't for that system that nobody gave me, I just created that space. I just asked somebody hey, can I come to you to ask for questions? And I went to them. And the same thing when I transitioned into academia, I had my peer and I had our cohort, and I had a place to go. I also had leaders that I admired that I would follow and just like see what they were doing and take the advice in and just like let it absorb and allowed myself to be like coached, you know, through some of the, from their experiences. And so I thought that was super helpful. But, you know, I think one of the hardest transitions is realizing when you are done and, you know, being okay with being done. It was super hard for me to leave school librarianship. It was also really hard for me to leave academia, because you're just like, what if this happens? Will I ever be able to go back? You know, there was a shortage of school librarians. Is there still going to be a shortage later? For academia, it was like, you know, should I leave? You know, it's so hard to get into. Will I ever get to go back? But ultimately, it was like, you know, what was the best thing for my well-being and my family? Knowing when it's time to call it quits is, I think, something that's successful to people's transition. You know, like it's hard to stay at a job where you may not be growing or it's not good for your well-being. And sometimes it's hard because it's, you know, like internally our perfectionists, we want to like, it's our own failure, but in reality it isn't, you know, it is what it is. And there's always, you know, everything happens for a reason. And so now at a state library, it's very different, but I very much enjoy the work. I get to do all the outreach that I was hoping to do, like in my other positions. And I get to still work with school librarians. I get to still work with academic librarians and public librarians and not just librarians. I get to work with like library staff. And I think that's really cool. So successfully transitioning, I think it's because, you know, being able to have a group of people that you can go to when you have questions or when you need help. And if you're not given those people, it's okay to ask for it. Sending random emails to people is something I'm known to do. So I will send people emails and ask for just an informational talk and just, you know, like, hey, I really admire your work. I'd love to talk to you about this. Because there are people that are willing to talk to you. And if they're not willing to talk to you, then maybe they may be really busy, but also like maybe there's somebody else that would be a better like peer mentor or mentor. Did I answer the question? I'm a rambler.
No, that was great. It was great. And it's just as good to hear about all of your different types of experiences that you had in libraries. Also, I think your background is interesting, your background in architecture and education. And you've spoken a little bit already about how education has kind of come into play. But how does architecture as a discipline inform your work in libraries?
Mm-hmm. So with architecture, I've always loved design and organization and also have really liked to always be learning. And so my design background has helped me with providing like a foundation of like how people navigate through our built space, right? Especially like our libraries. And in the built environment, there are inequities that exist because people that are designing them may or may not be thinking of women or different types of abilities or like this function of the space versus the design. And so I think my design background has provided me an opportunity to really look at space, both our physical space and our digital space, and apply like universal design principles to how we approach how people navigate our spaces. And so this helps me kind of focus my work with like an accessibility lens in the front of my mind. And then my experience as an educator has helped me with instruction. So it's about the design experience as well as how people are processing that information. And so pedagogy is something that I'm constantly trying to rethink and stay current with, because it's in these, you know, it's like when you go to a webinar and you're like, man, I am lost. I don't know what this person is saying. I've been zoned out for a little bit, versus when you go to a webinar that's like, man, that was great from beginning to end. And so like that type of information design, both through trainings or webinars or on our website, or something that I try to bring to the table. And I'm able to bring to the table because of my background. And it's something that it is one of my strengths, but it's something that I keep trying to grow on, and I try to learn and do research. So.
Well, that was great.
Yes, thank you for sharing that with us. I'm always interested in you know, because as librarians, a lot of us have other, like, second degrees or just different backgrounds as far as our undergrad work. And I think it's always, because, you know, to get a master's degree in library science, it kind of doesn't matter what your other, you know, degrees are. Like, it doesn't factor into getting into library school. So it's always interesting to hear how librarians are able to kind of pull in with those other areas that they've studied in into their librarianship.
Yeah, and it's great. It's a great way to bring people in with different skills. Like, a lot of our skills are soft skills that are transferable. And everyone has also like lived experience that they can bring to the table. And I think how we envision, or how I was initially envisioned libraries, is very different than what it actually is. And so if you're someone that's thinking about libraries, but you don't have that humanities or literature background, that's okay, right? Because we have librarians in the medical field and in STEM and in art and architecture. And so there are so many ways we could use our backgrounds.
I agree. As long as we keep that same mindset, because I think some people aren't open to that. They're like, if you don't have library experience, no, you can't come in. And then some people, you have library experience, but you didn't have your MLIS or your MLS. So no. So we gotta cut that gatekeeping out and hold people accountable for that nonsense.
Yeah, find ways to, like, in our state, we're, you know, your state organizations may have opportunities for like scholarships. You know, if you're interested in pursuing an advanced degree, you may be able to get a scholarship to go become a librarian. So there's that opportunity. I know the Public Library Association has like summer internships for high school students, which is a great way to bring in representation. And so, yeah, if our organizations, especially our like professional associations, can keep creating these opportunities and providing the support for continued advancement, I think we could do some great things. So I'm hopeful that libraries will, and library organizations will, step up to that challenge.
I'm hopeful as well. Keep up the fight.
Yes.
I'm always ready to fight.
And I think, you know, a lot of individual libraries are definitely trying to do that. But like you said, part of, you know, the key, I think, also is the organizations as a whole and what they're doing to make those changes as well. Because individual libraries can only do so much, right? Mm-hmm. We need the organizations to actually set the tone and kind of set the path.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that is all, folks.
It is. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was wonderful.
Hope you learned more about Laura Tadena. We'd like to share a quote with you before we sign off.
All I need to do is try and do the best that I can do. Selena Quintanilla Perez.
Remember to keep walking in your lived voices, and please follow us on all of our social media pages.